You're listening to the top stories of 2016 on WFHB.
We bring you the most significant stories of the year
as they were reported by your friends and neighbors.
The face of Bloomington continues to transform
while local residents fight to save parts of the city they love.
Local people joined protests near and far
as Hoosiers help elect Republicans across state and federal governments.
From local to state to national news,
WFHB brought you the stories affecting our community.
Here are the top stories of 2016 on WFHB.
Welcome to the top stories of 2016. For WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn. Today's story, Downtown Development, is number 8 on our countdown. You may have heard this comment, "Bloomington doesn't look like the town I remember." You may have even made a similar comment yourself. Bloomington is changing, and in the eyes of some, acquiring a little too much of an urban look and feel. As in 2014 and 2015, Bloomington residents saw plans approved for major developments in 2016 that will change downtown Bloomington and some nearby areas. We begin with Duke Energy's plan to locate an electrical substation downtown on the northwest corner of Rogers and 11th Streets. Correspondent Jared Dill brought us this substation story in June. The story is introduced by News Director Joe Crawford.
A plan for a new electrical substation near City Hall is drawing the ire of local residents who say the proposed design will be a blight on the Maple Heights neighborhood and the new trades district. Correspondent Jared Dill brings us that story.
Tomorrow evening, the Bloomington City Council will be holding its first meeting to discuss a proposal from Duke Energy to install a new electrical substation. Planned for a piece of mostly vacant land near the intersection of 11th Street and Rogers Street, the substation will displace two existing businesses. Duke says the substation is necessary to continue supplying electricity to the growing downtown area, as well as laying the groundwork for the proposed Trades District development, which is intended to host tech firms that are likely to consume large amounts of electrical power. Duke spokesperson Lou Middleton lays out the case for the new substation.
The downtown area of Bloomington, including parts of the IU campus, have really been growing in the past several years. That kind of growth translates into a higher demand for electricity. And right now, the substations that we have in place are just about at their maximum capacity to deliver reliable energy to our customers. So what we need to do is to install another substation to help balance the load better among all those substations so that we don't run the risk of outages, unplanned outages, or not being able to serve our customers. So it's because of the need that we build the substation. Now, concerning the location or the proposed location of the substation, the best thing to do from an engineering standpoint is to locate the substation as close as you can to where the load is. And in this case, the growth in the demand for electricity has been in that downtown area. So, we need to locate it as closely to there as we possibly can.
Residents of the Maple Heights neighborhood, which borders the train tracks running alongside the proposed site, want Duke to move the substation out of their neighborhood or switch to an alternate design. Chris Sturbaum, the city councilman whose district includes the proposed site, thinks the substation will be a blight on the continuing development of Bloomington's near west side.
Well, just that all the positive notes of development that have been happening over there, the Beeline Trail, City Hall, the resurgent Maple Heights neighborhood, west side is kind of blossoming, and then here's this kind of weed in the middle of the garden that doesn't make any sense.
Duke says the proposed design already has screening, including berms and trees. Duke's website for the new substation includes digital renderings that simulate the view from the street, and they make the substation look almost invisible. Earthen berms topped by trees hide most of the substation from pedestrian and auto traffic, and a tree line separates it from the Maple Heights neighborhood, along with a set of train tracks. Duke says this screening is both effective and cheap.
We have proposed in our initial proposal a screening plan that we believe meets the criteria of providing adequate screening from the neighborhood, while at the same time being a probably the most cost-effective screening plan that we can come up with.
Chris Sturbaum is extremely skeptical of Duke's claim that the substation will be adequately hidden.
Leaves fall off trees. Trees on drawings are 30 years old, and they get planted when they're 5 years old. So you totally see this thing. It's and you, of course, not to mention the 50-foot-tall power lines that come in, which there's nothing we can do about that. But to the pedestrian on the street, there's this, I've said this before, but that site is, this was a little Greek town, that would be where the temple would be. It's the top of the hill, it's the highest point, and it's got a substation on it.
Sturbaum and the Maple Heights Neighborhood Association have proposed the idea of asking Duke to switch to an alternative substation design that would blend in more with upcoming developments for the area, including the Trades District. Behind the trees and the berms, the current proposed design looks a lot like any other substation in Bloomington, a chain-link fence surrounding a bunch of electrical equipment. The residents want to see the substation enclosed by a wall or a building facade instead of a fence. This practice is common in denser cities, which often hide public infrastructure inside fake buildings designed to blend in with the surrounding architecture. Sturbaum cited the example of a substation in Traverse City, Michigan. When viewed from the street, that substation appears to be a small retail space attached to a large warehouse-like building. But the roof of the building is open to the sky, and inside it is the familiar equipment of a substation.
I was at the New Urban Conference, and I mentioned that this was one of the problems of new urbanism and new growth. And this guy from Traverse City said, hey, we built a substation right downtown. We built a brick wall around it that looks like a building, and it's open on the top so it breathes. And we put a donut shop, a building that now has a great donut shop right in front of it. And the citizens don't even know there's a substation there. But they do know there's a donut shop there. So it's completely appropriate. And we're saying to Duke, let's do a win-win situation here. Let's talk to the community and let's build something that will contribute to the Trades District, not detract from it.
When asked about alternative screening plans, Duke spokesperson Lou Middleton reiterated that the current plan met their requirements and was the most cost-effective. He also made the argument that increases in costs, such as more expensive substation designs, would eventually be passed on to Duke's customers. The city council may not be able to do anything to stop Duke from building the substation. Duke is regulated at the state level, and state law says Duke can effectively ignore local zoning laws. This means Duke doesn't have to get approval from the Plan Commission. However, the City Council does need to grant a vacancy for Duke to use two sections of street and two alleyways. If the City Council refuses, Duke could go to court and claim eminent domain. As a public utility, Duke would be likely to win that case. Duke has used eminent domain power recently in larger projects to construct transmission lines elsewhere in the state of Indiana. Chris Sturbaum says the vacancy request is an opportunity to pressure Duke into changing their plan into something more palatable for residents.
The state legislature has made it so that we don't zone them. They're like IU. They just come in and they can build they want without going through a plan commission. What we would try to establish would be an agreement, a conditional agreement in the vacation whereby we discuss and they make allowances for design. And that's something to be worked out because, you know, what's interesting is this is the first new urban substation that we've had to deal with in my lifetime.
City Council members, neighborhood associations, and representatives of Duke Energy negotiated through the summer. Ultimately, Duke agreed to surround the substation with an 18-foot-high wall to screen it and will contribute to landscaping installed and maintained by the city. Duke will also offer for sale surrounding land it doesn't use for the substation, the idea being that any new businesses constructed there could act as an additional screening device. Lucy Shake of the Maple Heights Neighborhood Association said though her group didn't get all the changes they wanted from Duke, quote, some real wins were achieved on all sides, unquote. Listening to the top stories of 2016 on WFHB. In today's episode, we take a look at a few of the developments approved for in and around downtown Bloomington. We just heard about the Duke Energy substation to be constructed at the northwest corner of Rogers and 11th Streets. Also this year, Bloomingtonians had to come to terms with the developer's big plans for the site of the much-loved Chocolate Mousse on South Walnut Street. The popular 1950s-era ice cream shop will be absorbed into a modern mixed-use development to be called Urban Station. The organization Indiana Landmarks called on Chocolate Mousse lovers to lobby the Bloomington Historic Preservation Commission to save the local landmark with a historic designation, but that effort failed. The four-story Urban Station will feature commercial space on the ground floor and a 54-unit apartment complex above. In this next story, Urban Station's developers, HM Mack, score a 10-year tax abatement for providing 15 affordable housing units within the development. The story comes from Cats Week, a collaboration of WFHB and Community Access Television Services. The story is read by anchor Adam Stillwell.
The City of Bloomington and developer HM Mack have come to a final agreement on just how much of a tax break the city will give for what's been dubbed the Chocolate Mousse Project. Discussions have been ongoing about how to include and pay for affordable housing units in the $11.5 million housing complex on South Walnut Street, where the Chocolate Mousse now stands. This latest agreement, approved in the City Council's August 31st meeting, provides a $1.3 million 10-year tax break in exchange for 15 bedrooms of affordable or workforce housing. Councilmember Isabel Piedmont Smith led the negotiations.
The workforce units will also remain in perpetuity, or as long as we can legally define that, which is 99 years, at an affordable rate. And even with fluctuations in what the living wage may be and what the market value of the units may be, it would never exceed 85% of what the market rate of these apartments may go for.
The council previously approved the site as an economic development target area in its July 13th meeting. Saying she wasn't a fan of tax abatements, Piedmont Smith said the number of units and the longevity of the arrangement will serve as a model for the future. Councilmember Steve Volan described the arrangement as precedent-setting.
We've gone back and forth trying to figure out what would be fair, but I think that the resulting amendment is substantially an improvement over the initial proposal for simply 5% of the beds for a three-year abatement. We think that this is the way that we should be wielding tax abatements to bring affordable housing to Bloomington.
According to Volan, the city is getting the better end of the deal.
We've done the math on this, and the amount of rebated rent or of reduced rent that will accrue to workforce housing over the next century, but from the get-go, will be substantial and substantially more than the amount the petitioner will receive in tax breaks.
Councilmember Chris Sturbaum said, quote, what we know is the market will not build this kind of housing by itself, unquote.
I'm very pleased with my fellow council members for negotiating this increase in affordable housing. It's substantial. And it's an excellent use of the tax abatement. It's a way to create, to have a public good that is shared by the large public so that no one's paying a lot. And in fact, after 10 years, there will be no cost and there will be increased taxes from this property.
Councilmember Andy Ruff explained further.
Just to make sure that the public understands, it's not really that any taxes are foregone. Any taxes are not realized by the community under a tax abatement like this. They're picked up in a small increment by the other property-owning taxpayers of the community. And if we believe that this is a community good, then it makes sense. I think it's logical and justifiable to think of spreading that that small increase that would support this project over the rest of the taxpayers in the community.
In a related action, the council adopted an amendment to the agreement that would broaden eligibility for the affordable housing units, also called workforce housing. The city's assistant director for small business, Jason Carnes, explained.
Basically, as we looked closer at this, we realized that the original language was too specific in who would have been eligible for these workforce housing units. It basically would have made it so you would had to make exactly $12.32 an hour, which is the Bloomington living wage. So what this does is it kind of sets the parameters. And like was mentioned, you have to hit number one, which is you have to hold a full-time job of at least 35 hours a week. And then under number two, you have to be able to check off the box, so to speak, for one of those two. Either total household income is less than 80% of area medium income for your size, or all the wage earners have to earn less than the Bloomington living wage. This way, it really, we feel this captures the demographic that we're targeting with workforce housing. Also in the second whereas, it kind of defines the prices of those bedrooms at $641 for a one bedroom and $1,282 for a two bedroom. And it has language that allows for inflation with consumer price index.
Volin asked City Attorney Thomas Cameron how a prospective resident would be certified as qualifying.
What I imagine happening, and because it hasn't been written, it's still conjecture on some level, is the person who wishes to take advantage of this program will have to show that they have employment and that they have a qualifying income.
To whom?
I believe it will start with petitioner, with HM MAC, and that there will be a process by which that is reported to the city.
Okay, so the city will certify.
Yes.
That this person is eligible.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Urban Station is now under construction. According to its website, it will open in August. Listening to the top stories of 2016 on WFHB. In today's episode, we take a look at a few of the developments coming to downtown Bloomington and the surrounding area. We just heard about the Urban Station being built on South Walnut Street. In Dunn Hill, a 740-unit student-oriented apartment complex will replace the existing and much smaller Dunn Hill apartments. The density of the new complex raised the ire of residents of nearby Garden Hill Historic District. They considered the area to be overdeveloped and said they would suffer vandalism and violence as a result. This story on the October City Council meeting is read by WFHB anchor Ryan Stacey.
Developers of a proposed high-density student housing complex planned for Dunn Hill are facing tough criticism from area residents. In the October 5th meeting of the City Council, residents of the Garden Hill neighborhood complained of the noise, violence, and parking issues they experienced from the area's existing student housing. Carrie Slaw of the Garden Hill Neighborhood Association said Dunn Hill site will certainly be developed, but she's concerned about overdevelopment.
Garden Hill and the area around the stadium has been systematically overdeveloped due to city-made growth policies and land use decisions dating back to the 1970s. This area experiences increasing public safety issues, including inescapable noise, mad parking, vandalism, and violence as demographic diversity decreases. This is simply not sustainable.
Slough says local police don't want to or can't deal with what she termed the negative spillover effect of high-density student development. CA Ventures and RCR Properties are developing the six-acre property located at the northeast corner of 17th and Dunn Streets. They are petitioning the council to rezone the site from residential high-density multifamily to planned unit development. The site plan describes 4- and 5-story buildings with a mix of apartments and townhomes. The complex would include a pool, a 540-space parking garage, and a greenway connecting 17th and 18th Streets as an alternate route for pedestrian and bicyclist use. The 746 bedrooms will be leased individually, and an additional fee will be charged for parking. A separate building offering 4,000 square feet of retail space is planned for the northwest corner of the site. Garden Hill resident Margaret Grescher and other residents echoed Slough's complaints and said the city isn't responsible for providing student housing. Slough said catering to IU's housing needs to go contrary to the city's stated goal of protecting core neighborhoods.
We don't have to put them anywhere, and certainly not in densities compounding already existing density issues. The city of Bloomington has become a residentially segregated community. Don't continue this process by approving a PUD. Recognize there is no mandate, no law, no ordinance, only the assumption that we must put them somewhere. Indiana University has the capacity to house students as necessary, to put sophomores back on campus and to build housing should the need arise. We simply don't make it necessary, and it's time to start now.
An IU student named Justin provided an alternate viewpoint and credited off-campus living with contributing to his personal development.
Living off-campus has been incredible for me in developing my adult life and in developing the skills I've needed to live outside of the university. And the idea is that allowing students to live off campus helps them become adults, which is the point of college after all.
7 council members passed rather than cast yes or no votes during a straw poll at the end of the meeting. Council member Dorothy Granger, one of the members who passed, said students aren't all bad, but she acknowledged the neighbors' concerns.
On the face of it, I really like the project. I just it's close to campus. There's parking in the stadium. It just, you know, it works. But the neighbors have valid points, and I'm hoping that maybe what we can do is, I understand my colleague Mr. Volan is working on trying to get a parking district, and maybe that would help facilitate some of that. I don't want to vote no just to because students are bad. Students are not bad. They are on game day, they might be bad, but then visitors are bad. So it's just a challenge to the community, and it's what we have to live with. And also, I'm not seeing that IU accepts a lot of responsibility for trying to move their student population into the community. And I don't know that we have a lot of options here.
Councilmember Susan Sandberg also passed on the straw poll.
It's really kind of more on us as a city, I think, to ameliorate this impact that we know is coming. One of the commenters talked about the buses. We're going to need to definitely increase our buses, so transportation is going to be kind of needed to be pulled in here. We're going to need to deal with the noise ordinance to make sure it is fully implemented with respect to how close this particular very dense project bumps up against a core neighborhood. We're going to have to think in terms of behavior management. When students gather in large parties, they sometimes lose their judgment, and they sometimes cause problems for a core neighborhood. So hopefully we can come to a balance of how we can see this move forward and also really take a look at the serious impacts that the people who live next door to this very dense project will have to face.
During negotiations with the city, the developers agreed to make a $1 million contribution toward affordable housing. Sandberg noted the developer was not required to make the contribution.
There is no ordinance that requires any developer to contribute to the greater public good through the city's efforts to put more affordable housing online. And so their contribution to the fund that will be used at the city's discretion for housing incentives and housing projects, I think, is quite exciting. Along with the Moose Project, these are kind of groundbreaking in that the petitioner voluntarily agrees to these terms before the city has had an opportunity to really think through an ordinance that does clarify and codify what the city desires to do with affordable housing.
Project plans were approved in November. The concerns of Garden Hill residents about invasive student parking may be eventually addressed by the City Council's newly conceived Parking Commission. We've highlighted just three developments approved this year, but there are others. Among them is a 36-unit affordable housing project slated for the west side of Rogers Street near the Trades District. You are listening to the top stories of 2016 on WFHB. We're counting down the most significant stories of the year as they were reported by our team of more than 100 citizen journalists. You just heard number 8 on our countdown, Downtown Development. Tune in tomorrow at 5:30 when story number 7 is revealed. The Best of 2016 is a production of the WFHB News Department. Jared Dill and News Director Joe Crawford contributed to today's report. For WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.